Hello and welcome to This Way Up. I'm Babette Gallard.
And I'm Terry Shakanovsky with a dilemma today because we're introducing Welcome Witboy. And my dilemma is his story is so extraordinary that I don't know how we're going to convey that, Babette.
Well, I think the best place to start is with what he's doing now, which is Bright Spark Foundation. And I'm using his own words here. He created that to prevent young people becoming copies of him. And in that he meant also what he did, which is quite difficult to hear, I have to admit.
Yeah, it was a very difficult conversation to listen to, but a very, very inspiring one, because as you'll hear, Welcome was sentenced at the age of 17, and you'll hear how that part came about, to 23 years in prison for violent crime. And once within prison, he had to join a gang, and the only way to survive, to move up in the gang, was through murder. He got a star on his shoulder every time he stabbed someone, and by the time he left jail, he had 8 stars on his shoulders.
And I think it should be said here, Terry, that he was only 25 when he had 8 stars on his shoulders.
Yes, because he is such an exceptional person and leader. It was a stratospheric career, ironically and terribly, you know, within that 28 gang.
And I found it very difficult to equate the man that we were sitting in front of and who we were talking to and who seemed warm, intelligent and very grounded with the man that he was at the age of 25. But then came restorative justice, and I think that was a point where his life possibly changed trajectory.
Yes, yes. I mean, there's lots to be heard in this conversation, but one of the things we'll hear about is how he met the daughter of one of the men he had murdered, and then together they work in Bright Spark.
Which seems almost unbelievable, but as you'll hear, it really happened, and now Bright Spark is taking in literally hundreds of youngsters who would otherwise have been written off by society.
Here's Welcome.
So I'm the founding director of a foundation called Bright Spark. Bright Spark Foundation was essentially created from my own personal life journey, but also as a vehicle to create opportunities for young people, opportunities which I never had when I was growing up. So I always think about that if there was a foundation like Bright Spark when I was growing up, I may not have made the negative or disastrous choices that I've made. And I kind of like thought to myself that if I could bring an organization like this to being, it will then be able to save many other young lives, and specifically young boys that end up on the streets, young girls that end up on the streets. And because of ending up on the streets, they either end up in gangs, in prison, or they end up dead. I wanted to put an end to that, and I wanted to give them hope, and I wanted to give them a spark that they are bright. They just need someone to just light that match that ignites our passion, that ignites our ability to achieve greatness. So that's the one reason why Bright Spark exists. Another reason for Bright Spark's existence was, it's also a constant reminder to myself that, number one, it's kind of like a home for me, away from the danger, away from the temptation, away from going back to a life of crime, because I'm so busy with my work that I don't have time to think of anything else. So it's kind of like also my saving grace in a way, because you do know that there's a lot of offenders that reoffend because they come out of prison and they don't get jobs, they don't have anything to do, so they tend to just return to a life of crime. It's also helping me.
And how come, Joburg, where did you grow up?
I grew up, I was born and bred in Cape Town, yeah, on the Cape Flats.
Yeah.
A little community called Valhalla Park, which is on the Cape Flats line. And then after being released from Portsmouth Prison, and I didn't want to stay in Cape Town because there was a lot of temptations in that place itself. Because I remember coming out of prison, you know, being people knocking at the door, wanting to invite me back into the gangs. And I was like, that's not welcome anymore. So I felt that there was a whole lot of having to consistently prove my rehabilitation, prove my change. So I need a change of scenery. And Johannesburg became my change of scenery.
And the gangs didn't follow you to Joburg?
I think they couldn't afford the transport.
Would you mind telling a little bit just the outlines of that story?
Yeah, so, you know, like many other young people, I grew up in a household loving parents, specifically my grandparents. I predominantly grew up with them. My parents were there, but they were always busy. So I had a very absent father. He believed that providing for whatever I needed was more important than being present. I never really had a relationship with my father. There was no teaching me how to play ball, teaching me how to play soccer, teaching me certain things. I had to learn these things either through reading, speaking to other men. You know, growing up in a place like Valhalla Park, it was infested with gangs, drugs. So really trying to get a role model in an area like that was difficult. So the gangs became the men that we looked up to, that would be the ones that would provide for the community. And many of the gangs would buy groceries, they would help the community, and they would help if our mothers were struggling, they would give them money. But we did not know the agenda behind that. So we just felt like these men are doing awesome work. And then I got sucked into that world because I was fascinated by the cars, fascinated by the lifestyle. I was fascinated by how they lived their lives. And I was a straight A student, doing well at school, constantly pushing myself, because a part of me wanted to get out of this community, but I realized that it was still a long way to go. So I got sucked into the gangs, later on becoming part of them. And some people used to say to me that it's inevitable that you're going to end up in the gangs because that's your area, that's the community you grow up in. And what was fascinating about when I joined the gangs was the big disregard they had for education. They saw education as a weapon of the white people to manipulate and to keep us where we were. So we were constantly getting these little messages of education is not important, education is not important. And another thing that I also learned within the gangs as I was joining them was that there's nothing beyond where you are at. So if you are in this community, this is your community. Beyond this community, nothing exists. So I didn't know of the V&A waterfront. I didn't know of Worcester. I didn't know of the Winelands. I did not know of Stellenbosch. I was just in Valhalla Park. The world was that small for me that moment. And I was naive. I was stupid. I was easy. And I fell for it. And got initiated to get, you know, to join the gangs. Did what they did, robbed, stole, broke in. And I remember being initiated to join the gang. I had to, you know, you have to kill someone so that you can be part of the gang. Then they will really take you seriously because you've taken a life. And I did not understand the value of life at that moment. The only thing that I wanted to understand was my value of belonging, my sense of being part of something.
And of being a man.
And of being a man. And in this space, being a man meant showing other men that you are prepared to do something such as taking another person's life, because that connected you, that bonded you, because you now were seen as you are not afraid. And I did that, you know, and then got into the gangs and accepted, but then got arrested. So I was 17 years old when I was arrested, had my entire life ahead of me. I even felt at that moment when I was arrested, you know, I was just going to be told that you are a first offender. They'll just give you 6 months and you'll be okay. And they promised that even though if you tell the judge that we are not part of this, the men that I was arrested with, they were older than me. If you tell the judge that you don't know us, that we are not part of you, we will take care of you. We will come and visit you in prison. We'll send you money. And it was crazy because I believed them and I was naive enough to think so. So I remember that day stepping up into the dock and a judge looked at me and said, "Welcome, I've been told that these other persons that are with you in this case, you don't know them and therefore you are taking this case upon yourself." I said, "Yes, Your Honor." And he gave me 23 years in prison. And I remember that day like it was yesterday. It was on the 21st of November, 1999. And he looked at me and he said, "I want to make an example. And I want to let you know that you are a cancer to society and that you do not deserve to be free. And I remember being transported from court to Portsmouth Prison, which still, as today, is one of the 5 most deadliest prisons in the world. And going in there as a 17-year-old, I thought that, I mean, I was in the gangs outside, it would be fine. But I did not realize that the prison had a totally different way of operating. It was much more dangerous, much more insidious. And the first thing that I met when I got there was asked this question, who are you in prison? And the guy asking me that question, I'm like, welcome. And he slapped me in my face. And he asked me this question again, who are you in prison? And I said, welcome. And he slapped me in my face again. And I clearly got the message that I wasn't welcome here. And the guy standing next to me, when he answered, he said, Frans van Tshonalanga, and nothing happened to him. Only then did I realize that the prison had 3 numbers that you had to belong to. It was either 26, 27, or 28. And if you were none of those, you were beaten, you were abused, and certain things happened to you. So you had to choose, as you came into prison, which number you want to belong to. And the guy next to me chose to be part of the 28. So when he said what he said, I repeated that when they asked me again, who am I in prison? And then I was cool, nothing happened. But then I became a 28 by default.
Can I ask, and the previous gang members, did they support you at all?
So as I was in prison, and in prison we get visits every Saturday. And so I was like, every time I heard my name being called, I thought it was them, but then it was my grandmother. The next weekend, called my name, I thought it was them, it was my grandmother. Every time, it was my grandmother. And I realized that these men are not going to come. They are not going to support my family. They're not going to do anything that they said they're going to do. I was in prison for the entire year. Never did I get a visit from them. After 5 years of not getting visits from them, I gave up. And I decided that I'm in prison right now. I need to understand that I'm on my own.
And now you were a 28.
Yeah, now I'm a 28. Now I'm part of these gangs. And I remember that as I was sitting there, I was thinking to myself that I was so naive to believe the lie. And these are the lies that many of the young people that we work with are being told, that it's about brotherhood. It's about us doing this together. And if you're in trouble, we're going to be there for you. But the minute you enter prison, they disappear. So I had to learn that the hard way. So my life literally became that. So as I was, you know, progressing and living my life in prison, I was offered an opportunity to say, listen, you can't just be a normal 28. You need to climb the ranks. You need to get respect. People need to see you. And this is where they offered me a position of saying, if you stab a correctional officer, you'll get a rank on your shoulder and you'll start moving up the corporate ladder. So they made an offer and said, listen, if you stab a correctional officer, we will give you a rank. And that's how you will start becoming who you need to become. And people will start fearing you and they will respect you. And you will also be one of those that makes the rules of what goes on in prison. Needless to say, I fell for that hook, line, and sinker, because I felt like there's nothing else for me. I'm going to be here for 23 years. I might as well get with the program. I mean, imagine being locked up for 23 hours, 1 hour exercise. There was no green grass. There was no trees. It's just concrete. You're looking, that's all you look at. It's like you look out of the window. You don't see anything nature. You just see concrete. And it was a cold place. And when they made that offer, I felt like, okay, cool, no problem, I can do that. So they pointed out the individual that I need to stab. And I went up and I stabbed the correctional officer. So now being told that in order to be seen, in order to be respected, you need to stab a correctional officer. And when you stab a correctional officer, you get 1 star tattooed on your shoulder. And that's how it works. You know, if you want to stab another one, you get another star tattooed on your shoulder. I was 21 when I did my first stabbing, 24 when I did my second. I was 25 years old when I had 4 stars on both my shoulders. By this time, I now became the general of the 28s. So I was in charge of all of these men. And remember, when I first came to prison, they were looking down on me. I was the one that they used to send around to do whatever they needed done. But now I was the one in charge of them, telling them what to do. So my story in prison was more of a rags to riches kind of story, because I was the youngest general at the age of 25. When generals would be, 40, 50. But I had to climb this ladder so quickly that I became the youngest at the age of 25. But the responsibility of being a general was crazy. So it was crazy to see 2,500 men under my control and having to make sure that the prison ran like a well-oiled machine, having to make sure that there was less fights and then more productivity, because drugs needed to be sold, prostitution, money had to be made, people had to get their cuts. Everybody wanted a part and a piece of what was happening in prison. And it's true what they say, prison does run on its own axis. And it's all about survival.
But you had an innate ability to organize. You were a young person, but you had that ability and you gained respect for that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what I think you've taken out into what you're doing now, right?
No, for me, I feel like being in the numbers gang has taught me not just to survive prison, but it has also taught me how to plan, how to coordinate. It was not just about staying alive. Anyone can stay alive in prison. You can become a male prostitute, sell yourself to other men, but they get tired of you and then they discard you. So that's not really staying alive. You could stay alive by sharing information from one gang to the next gang until you get caught and then killed. You could take information from the gangs to the police, but when they find out, you still die. I felt like I needed to be in charge of the system and know that therefore I can run it for as long as I want it to run. But in order for me to do that, I needed to be at the highest seat. I always think of Clayton McKenzie when I think about this, that you can't really make the changes in government that you want. You literally need to get into government to make the changes that you want. So it taught me not just survival skills, but leadership skills, how to coordinate, how to plan, and how to put things into perspective. And being a leader in the gangs taught me a lot about myself. There were moments when I did not want to be where I was because I had to make tough decisions, where I felt that certain people did not need to get hurt, but they got hurt and they needed to get hurt so that I do not come across as weak. And I consistently had to be someone else to please other people. But if it was me, I would have grace. I would have shown mercy. And as a general, I never slept with my eyes closed. It was always having one eye open, making sure that nobody's going to want my chair because they would kill you and take your position. And I didn't want that to happen. I didn't want to die in prison. So I constantly realized that I want to survive this place.
So you came to a moment where you actually wanted to change that.
Exactly.
So what was it that pushed you finally into the end where you said no?
I think for me, it was a situation where I was sitting at the courtyard and men were sitting in front of me and they were having a conversation about what they had done outside before they came to prison. And they were laughing about it. The one was talking about raping and killing. And they were talking as if it was nothing. The other one was talking about if he would be given a chance to leave prison, he would do it again because it's his job. And at that moment, I realized that if I were to be a father, how would I be able to protect my daughter against men like this and against a man like myself? Because these men that were sitting there were me. I was them. And I was also thinking about if people would ask my daughter, tell us about your father, would my daughter be able to talk about me proudly or would she be ashamed of me? And it was at that moment that I realized that I didn't want this life for me. I wanted a different life. I wanted to change my life. And that's when I decided that I'm stepping out of the gangs. And it wasn't an easy decision, but I believe it was a decision that I needed to make. And I remember making this decision, going to the head of prison and saying to him that I need four other generals to come to the prison. He now needs to transfer four other generals to his prison to come and listen, to the reasons why I don't want to be a general anymore, because they are the only ones that can decide whether I live or die. So that happened. And as these generals arrived, I had to go and meet them. And the rule was I couldn't enter into the room where they were dressed. I had to be naked because I could be concealing a knife, kill them and take their prisons. So I entered this room completely naked, standing there. Two of these generals were standing in front of me. The other two were standing behind me. And according to ritual and symbolism, the two in front were the judges. They were the ones that were needed to hear my story. The two at the back, they were the executioners. And both of them had knives. And if my story did not make sense and they did not understand why I wanted to leave and I posed a threat to the rest of the organization, they would stab me in the back, both of them simultaneously in my kidneys, twist the knives, pull it out, and I would bleed out. And in 5 minutes, I'll be dead. But something interesting happens, though, if I die. So because I'm at 28, for 8 days, the prison will go on lockdown. They will celebrate me. They will sing. Everybody will say what a great general welcome was. And then after the 8 days, somebody else will ascend the position of a general. And that's it. And I realized that my legacy will literally be 8 days. Imagine having a legacy of 8 days after everything you've done, after all the money you've raised, after the way you've ran the prison, after everything you've done. They are just giving you 8 days of remembrance. I was like, it's not a fair retirement plan. So I then said to them, guys, I'm out. And they asked me what my reasons were. And I said to them that I want to be a father. I literally want to see my children grow. I don't see a life in what we are doing. But obviously, I respect what you men are doing. And I'm also choosing to respect you moving forward. But I just don't want to be part of it. I remember being told to step out of the circle so that they can decide. And as I was asked that, one of these men said to me, welcome, before you go, do you remember 6 years ago? We were at Drakenstein prison. And you taught me to read and write. I was like, I can't remember, but I do know that I was at that prison. And he said, I received a letter from my family. You saw that I was struggling to read it. You took that letter, you read it to me, and you even asked me whether I wanted to learn to read and write. He said, you spent close to 4 months teaching me to read and write. I can read and I can write because of you. So the reason why I'm sitting and able to tell you my story is not how brutal I was, how dangerous I was. It was that one act of kindness that saved my life. And I always say to people that no matter who you are, whether you're a CEO, a very important person, the president of this country, those titles will fade. But the only thing that never fades in people's hearts and minds is that one act of kindness of you having given them that slice of bread, you having given them that money they needed to pay or buy a meal, that lift that you gave them to get them to an interview or to get them somewhere in life, that just that 1 minute of just listening to them, that one act of kindness changes everything. And that is what people remember for the rest of their lives.
And it saved your life.
And it saved my life. Whenever I do the work that I do, when I speak to the young people, when I go to the communities, when we do food parcels to families that I need, the only thing I think about is that because I was given an opportunity through an act of kindness, I want to inspire the rest of the world to do likewise. Because I may not bring back those that I had taken. I may not be able to replace the life of people that have died in me becoming the man that I became. But at least I have an opportunity to make the world a better place by inspiring people to give, to do things from a place of love and not from a place of anger, resentment, hate, fear, but rather love one another, be there for one another, support one another, and help one another. That's my message. And that's what I teach these young people to do, because in all of us is the need to just be good. But sometimes we need to be reminded of that good. And being kind is a reminder of how good we can actually be.
I've seen when you've had the young people sitting here and they're talking about where they've come from, what they're planning, what they're doing, Is that the message that you give them? Be kind, be honest.
I think from a place of being kind, there's a lot that happens. People would say, yeah, but you killed people and you're living this life. You should also be dead, you know? People say a lot of bad things because they don't understand the journey that I had to take to get here. Every single day when I do the work that I do, for instance, when I took the life of Mr. Jones, who was a correctional officer, I remember when his daughter spoke to me and said that my father was a good man and he believed in change. And he worked in the prison because he loved the work that he do. He was passionate about it. I feel like when I do the work that I do, it's like he sacrificed himself so that I can realize my potential to be a different person. And when I change the lives of other people, I do it because of him through me. So whether I had a hand at taking his life, I also feel that I have an opportunity to make it right by allowing his vision to live on through me.
So your legacy is more than 8 days.
So my legacy is more than 8 days. His life continues
through you,
through me. And I feel that is what people don't understand. It's that when you take a life of another person, there's a lot of remorse. There's a lot of things that you need to deal with to make peace with that. But it's firstly, you need to be able to forgive yourself so that you can get back to a road of healing. But after healing yourself, you then now need to go and heal that family, heal that community. And that's the foundation of the work that I do. It's not just about me. It's about preventing more copies of the negative me.
And coming up next, Welcome tells us how he did that, how he prevented more negative copies of himself, and how he met the daughter of the correctional officer that he killed.
Before we come on to talking more about the work you do, I just want to ask, so you met Mr. Jones's daughter?
Yes. So one of the most important things that I did while I was in prison, there was this program called Restorative Justice. It's a forgiving program that you need to attend before you get paroled. After I'd left the gangs, I was enrolled in that program. And I met a priest there, Father Baby Chan, and he was my mentor. He was the guy that really motivated me, that molded me. And he was the one that organized my bursary to study at UNISA. And I did my higher certificate in adult basic education and training. And I went to Restorative Justice. And as I was there, I was taught about forgiveness. I was taught about self-forgiveness. I was taught about you can't leave prison still angry at what you did. You need to forgive yourself so that you can start healing and become a healing for others. And one of the most important things that I had to do was to visit the victims, to go to them. And I remember this day, like it was yesterday, I left prison. I was out for a month. And then I plucked enough courage to go and visit. I had to find out where Mr. Jones' family stayed. I had to go and visit. And I went back and I realized that they were no longer living on the police terrain because the father was not there. So the mother moved them out and she moved back with her mom. And it was in a very, you know, it was Lavender Hill. It was also another gang-infested community. So I realized the impact of my crime is that I literally uprooted these kids from a comfortable life. They were at Model C schools. They were doing well. And here I came, took their father's life. And now they had to leave the private school. They had to go into the township schools. They had to face township problems. They had to face gassy issues. And when I went and I knocked on the door, the mother opened. She looked at me and she said that I knew this day would come for me to meet the man that took the life of my husband. She said, please come in, but please remember, that I had forgiven you. Even before you had knocked on my door, I had already forgiven you. She said, the only people that you need to convince of your forgiveness is my children. As I entered the house, I sat and the boy was standing there. He was in grade 10 at that moment. And he looked at me and I could see that he was angry. The girl stood behind me and she had just finished matric. And she said to me, you know how difficult it is for a girl like me to live in a community like this, every single day being harassed, every single day afraid whether I'm going to come home, afraid of whether I'm going to be raped or killed, because this is what this community is about. That is what you did to me. And the only thing I could say at that moment was, I'm here to ask for your forgiveness. And as we started Bright Spark Foundation, we started in Cape Town, and I asked Jamie, who is the daughter of Mr. Jones, if she could work with me, if she could be part of the organization as we started it. And she became our managing coordinator in Cape Town, and we worked beautifully alongside each other. And I remember when we used to do kids camps and we go to schools and we go out and we spend weekends in the bushes with the children doing life skills orientation programs, and we used to do boot camps with naughty children. I would stand next to her, and I have a beautiful picture of me and her standing next to each other, and I would ask her this question: how does it feel standing next to the man that took your father's life? And she says, if I look at these kids in front of us, there's one thing that I'm reminded of, is that my father wanted this to happen. We've saved thousands of children's lives. My father would be proud. And I'm proud to stand next to you and continue the work of my father. And so she works at our Cape Town office, and she's doing amazing work. But that was the relationship that we had formed after so many years of having to go back there. And that's the power of restorative justice, that it's not just about changing. It's not just about saying, I'm sorry. But it's about taking each other's hands, victim and offender, and walking this journey of healing together. And that's what Bright Spark stands for. Bright Spark stands for we heal together, because today you can be the victim, tomorrow you can be the perpetrator. So our objective as an organization is to not have victims, not have perpetrators, but have people that can support each other. No matter how hard life is, no matter how life calls for a shortcut. Like I say to the children when we sit in circles, it's like, yes, you don't have the food, but you don't have to go into the shop and steal. Because stealing that will get you into much deeper problems. You will go to prison. And once you are there, you will have to make other choices that lead to other things that's going to completely remove you from who you are. So ask for help. Out of the 1,000 people that you ask, one will give you that piece of bread. One will give you that 2 rand. One will give you that 10 rand that you need. You don't have to steal so that your entire life gets impacted by that one decision of hunger.
And not go to the gangs who seem to be helping.
Exactly.
But
and
not.
Because that's not help. Mm. It's, as I said, it's a shortcut. We teach our young people that don't take from the gangs. Don't go into joining gangs, because you are duped into believing it's an easy way. The more you do for them, the less you become of yourself. You forget who you are. I remember there's one thing I learned in the gangs that's so paramount, is when I do workshops with young people on your name. And I say to them that you know how important your name is, but when you're in the gangs, they take your name because they dehumanize you, because they know that they'll give you a gun and you have to go and kill someone that looks like you, that speaks like you. So the gangs, they impersonalize everything. They remove what makes you human and give you an identity that kind of like is cool to be called Scarface, but it's not. Because your mom and your dad, your grandparents, they gave you a beautiful name. You weren't born with a knife or a gun. You were born this bundle of joy where so much hope and aspirations of your family was there with you, and you had purpose. So our objective in Bright Spark is to say, we teach you to go back to your purpose. We teach you how beautiful it can be if you can just remember why you are here, because you are not here by accident. You are here to serve greater humanity.
How do you heal? How do you do that?
Mm-hmm.
Would you just explain the logistics?
So Brightspark operates in both Cape Town and Johannesburg. So we work in very vulnerable communities, especially communities infested by gangs. Even now, as we are working, our biggest problems might be Westbury, might be Rivoli, which is predominantly colored communities. But we also have other issues in Soweto, which is where most of our young people are becoming addicted to nyaope. They're becoming addicted to drugs. So now we have a bigger problem because those ones, they now commit crime in order to have the money to sustain their drug habits. So we have this push and pull where we have to work in both these communities so that we can bring them into this position of saying, what's your purpose? Get them off the drugs, get them out of the gangs, put them into a place of safety where we start working with them, go on camps with them, like really work through the process of who am I? Where do I see myself in the greater scheme of things? And we teach them a sense of responsibility to say that the phone that you have taken off Babette, there's a lot that she's losing because there's context on her phone. Her life is there. So you take away so much more than just the phone. So think about these things. We teach them on to think deeper, to think a bit further. We teach them that crime does not pay. It's nice when you do it in the beginning because everybody celebrates it and you go and you drink. But after that, someone is going to wake up crying because you did something that removed something greater. You killed a breadwinner, you killed a mother, you killed a father, you killed a child that did not deserve that.
What are the structures? Do you bring them to a center daily, weekly, or monthly?
So we predominantly work in communities that ask us. When communities are in need, they would communicate, they will contact us and say, welcome, we have a problem at our school. Bullying is happening. Kids are joining gangs. We would go there, address. We would also pinpoint which are the kids that are involved. We would do home visits. We would meet with their parents because we believe in a holistic approach. The school might identify the child as the problem, but we kind of like think that the problem might be much more than just the child. The problem might be at home. So we take the child, we go home, we see the circumstances under which the child lives. And then from there, we assess the need that needs to be brought into perspective. For instance, in many of the homes that we work, we always see child-headed households. We see single mothers. There are no fathers in many of the houses that we go into. So we know that there's a lack of a male figure or the importance of a father. And that is why many of the boys or the girls, they end up joining gangs because those are males. So they're yearning to be guided. We see many of the girls getting involved in relationships with older men because the only thing that they're looking for is their father. So that is the kind of work we do. We assess, and then once we've assessed and we see that we want to help this child or these children, so we take them out of the community and we put them into a program called School for Life, where we then house them for a year.
A residential program.
A residential program. We house them for a year. We feed them. And we place them in a safe environment where learning can take place. Because the first thing that these kids do not understand is discipline and rules. Because they're used to just going into a space where the mom is so drugged that the mom doesn't even know what's going on. So the child must make his or her own food. And if there's no food, he or she must go beyond, do certain things to get the food. So now this child comes into a space where there's plenty of food. Now they must be taught how to manage this food. And when you take a child that has never had the luxury of a pizza or the luxury of coffee or whatever they see, they tend to just go wild and eat uncontrollably. So now it's teaching them that sense of, this is food for you. It will be there tomorrow, because they step into that space afraid. They sometimes think that they do not deserve it. So they want to eat as much as they can because they still don't think it's real. They think that I might say to them tomorrow, we made a mistake, you need to go back. So we teach them and says, calm down, you are here. This is your space, relax. So we teach them how to just be normal again. We try to say, you deserve this. You deserve everything that you see around you. We introduce them to other schools in the area. We introduce them to other people. We take them out of the area that they're in, and we travel with them. We go to places like Sandton, we go to places like Bryanston, we go to places like, because some of them don't even know. I remember we took a group of kids to a restaurant. They were so nervous. They were walking so close to each other. They were like so nervous. The waiter even said, "Kids, what's going on? You know, you can space out, sit wherever you want to sit." They were like, "No," because it was like a culture shock that they've never been out of their communities. So that is what we do. We teach them to break free from the lies that are being told by gangs, that you do not deserve to be beyond this point. You do not deserve to have the pizza when you want it. First kill, then I'll get you a pizza. First steal, then I'll get you this nice thing. Girls first have sex with me, then I'll buy you this beautiful thing you want. Now, it's not about if you want the pizza, there's beautiful things you can do. Clean up our space and then get rewarded. Here's your slice of pizza because you worked hard as a team. You didn't have to kill anyone, didn't have to hurt anyone, didn't have to take anything from anyone. It is yours because you worked hard. Those are the processes that we teach them. That's how we break the culture, the hold of negativity over them.
And then after that year?
After that year, there's three processes to the program. There's the bronze, there's the silver, and then there's the gold. So they need to attain all of these steps as they go. We support them. When they get to the gold, they would be at high school. We will then support them further. We will then, from high school, move them into the GAP program, which is another program that prepares them for the university, that prepares them for tertiary education. And that we do in partnership with Henley Business School, we do in partnership with Wits University, we do in partnership with other universities to say, okay, cool, they've just finished matric. And then we do learnerships with companies like Metso, and they go in there and they learn, and they earn a stipend for the work that they do.
And roughly how many kids have come under your program so far, and how many do you have at the moment?
So over the years that we've worked, we've had thousands of kids. Our current number of kids, as we are sitting here within the year, is 372 kids in our program. We go into the families, we support these kids, but we realize that now we've removed the child from the family. We also need to take care of the family. So then we create food parcels that we give to the families every single month to make sure that they are okay. And we also try through our network, say, if the father is able to work, we get him a gardening job. If the mother is able to work, she gets this type of job. So we really build a relationship because our support needs to be holistic, because we can help the child, but if we don't focus on the mom or the dad or the other kids that are staying behind, what we're going to do is that this child is going to leave, go back into that situation, and then she will now have to become the only breadwinner, the only source. So we might do more harm than good. So we empower the entire family by putting systems in place to support the family. The food parcels are just a support mechanism to push them into a position of saying, you need to do it for yourself, but we'll show you how. We help them. You need to put in the CVs. We'll help you draft them. You need to put in the communication with certain people. We'll connect the dots. And then we will monitor. If the mother is going for the interview, we will find out from the person that she had, did she come for the interview? If the mother says, I couldn't go because I didn't have transport money, we'll say, don't worry, I'll call Babette. We'll get a donation of $250. We'll give you your money for the week. Go to the interview. We find ways to support them. And so when the child goes back to the family after a year, and if the child then gets chosen to be part of the GAP program after 2 years, the child goes back to a household that is stable. Mother is working, father is working. And you can see by the windows, there's glass. The house is properly painted. The door is fixed. The yard looks like a yard. You can see the child enters from one home to the next home. And that's our objective, is to build the communities. And then those communities then build each other. That's our job, saving the world one child at a time.
And how do you fund this?
That's a very good question. So we are self-funded. And the reason why we are self-funded is because we have tried getting funds from government, but we are kept being told stories. And not only that, but it's always a situation of we're not working in the right cluster. We are supposed to be working here and not there. We're supposed to be working with these kids and not these kids. And there's a lot of mandates that they assign to us. So we try to stay away from mandates. So we form partnerships with companies predominantly. I form partnerships with friends of mine. We come together. I do talks. And the money that I get at talks, a percentage of that goes into the foundation. So it helps with some of the admin and some of the teams that we need to get together. We put out posts. I mean, I'm very active on LinkedIn. I ask for money more often than anyone. It's as you said, it's not easy being a fundraiser, but I enjoy it. And we don't always get the money that we need. But I can tell you one thing, Terry, is like, it's like we get the job done. We can sit and we can stress, but then at the end of the day, it happened.
So can you plug yourself if people want to get behind you? Where can they find you? Tell us your socials. How can they get hold of you?
Yeah, no, it's just you go Google Brightspark Foundation SA, click on that link. It will take you to where we are at. Our offices are based in Highlands North, or just Google Welcome Witboy. Google my name. Everything is there. You'll find your way to us. We've got a Facebook page and I'm on social media most of the time. So they can always catch me on there. I'm always on ENCA or SABC talking, doing something. If you are meant to support us, your heart will direct you to us. You will find a way to us. I can remember with Babette. I mean, it was just automatic that her heart just went. Our main objective is we are a charity organization and charity is love. So your heart for service will show you, this is where I can go. This is where I need to be. And we'll see you.
The kids who've gone through your program, do they come back and offer support?
Many of the kids that come through our programs, they become peer educators. When we have programs, they go back. We sit in camps. They come back. They talk to their kids. We've got a few of them that are working in awesome companies. So they do give back and say thank you. But our objective is, yeah, because you've been given, also give. It's almost like alumni thing, like you've been there. So now just go back and see the kids that you were once.
And in the communities where you work, do you see the communities changing because they're seeing one family doing something?
Definitely. There's a lot of change. There's a lot of positivity because if the world is dark and we choose to become susceptible to the fear, and we become despondent and we draw back and we go into our corners and say, I don't want to participate. What we do is that we're helping wickedness grow. We're helping darkness grow. So we need to do the opposite. So go out there. I said to go out there, you know, have a life. Don't live in that bubble of fear. And because the only way that you can light the world is by being a candle. And in order to be a candle, you need to burn, baby.
But I want to ask you one more question, if I may, and it's more of a personal question. I'm turning to you because of what you've been through. Do you still believe that there's good in everybody?
But that's a very beautiful question. I always say to people, like I've said before, when you see this child come into the world, the happiness. I've worked in communities that are going through poverty, through heartache, through death, through pain. But the minute that mother gives birth, I've seen those communities come together. There's tears, there's happiness, there's joy. For that moment of labor, there is just happiness, there is joy in that space. So when a child comes into the world, I see the light enter the world. I've seen gangsters become better men because now they have a child. They change their lives because they say, I cannot be this brutal, evil person because I've got this beautiful baby girl that looks at me and that looks at me with hope. So when you ask the question, do I see good in people? People are good. They will always be good. The only thing that needs to happen is we cannot stop doing the good work to remind those good people to continue being good despite the circumstances. If I stop what I'm doing, then I give way to wickedness. I give way to darkness. We all have shadows. It is understanding that shadows, making friends with that shadow, that we can say to the shadow, you are not welcome in this space. You are not welcome here, but you can stay here. This is your corner. If we need to talk, we can talk. If we need to negotiate, we can negotiate. But there's places in my life, in the world, that you are not supposed to go to. It is a place of light. So be where you are. I'm welcoming you there, but do not take over. It is that constant communication with darkness that we need to have, because it is within our nature to be that. We cannot remove ego. If it wasn't for prison, I would not have become the man I am today. That darkness taught me everything about my light. Everything that I am, it has taught me. And that is why I do the work that I do.
A last question. For anybody who is inspired by what they've heard, who wants to do what you would do, are there any tips, anything you would do differently, anything you would want them to know? Anyone who wants to become a community change activist like you?
A person that wants to change the world, number one, my greatest advice would be you can't do it alone. You need people that have the same spirit, that have the same passion as you. You need to team up with people that have that passion, because those people will ultimately hold you accountable. You need to be a person of integrity to do things from a place of total transparency. If you start an organization or an NPO to help people, please, please, it's not about I've quit my job, I need money, and this is what I'm going to do. There's no money in an NPO. In fact, it's the opposite. You are giving away money daily. This is not Forex. It's real lives that you are dealing with. So it is a consistent giving away, a consistent having to give. But when you have your team, work from a place of rest and give from a place of love, and it will sustain you. Another thing that's also important in the work, that if you choose to do this, is family is important. Never forget your own family. What you're doing is amazing and the world will love you. If you work to a point where you're no longer there, your family will be the ones that will miss you. And the world will just say, well, we knew a guy called Welcome, and that's it. But it is your daughters, your sons that remain behind that needs to say, my father was everything to everyone, but he was nothing to me. And that's not the message you want your children to remember you with. You have to have balance. And another last thing that I can say is, be wary of corruption. Your organization will come up in the investigation and you will lose all the good work that you've done. So ask for advice, get the proper people to support you and to drop the paperwork. Just follow integrity. Just be integral. That's it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's a privilege. Absolutely. It's a privilege to talk to you.
And coming up next, Welcome tells us how he did that, how he prevented more negative copies of himself, and how he met the daughter of the correctional officer that he killed.
Gosh, Babette, listening to that, you can hear how devastated we both were. What a story it was.
I think one of the things that really surprised me was the way Welcome, he described his time in prison as a career, which is...
Wasn't that amazing? The climb, he actually used the phrase, climb the corporate ladder.
Yeah.
And then the details of that emerged, that he summons, you know, the prisoner governor summoned the generals for him to, you know, get release from. And he talked about the money he had raised for the jail. I mean, it was truly a business. It's terrifying.
And in some ways moving. When he was talking about Mr. Jones, who he stabbed, I could see that he was very emotional and close to tears. And so was I.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you said you actually wrote about it in your blog.
We did.
How touched you were by him saying, I don't want more negative copies of myself.
That stays with me. And I think it's something, oddly, that I'm carrying with me now. Do I want more copies of me? This is really something to think about.
Yes. I mean, it was such a dramatic story. But I guess, as with every human story, there are versions of it in our own little lives. The one that got me was sometimes we're victims, sometimes we're perpetrators. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about a literal, very dramatic scale of murder or life. But of course, it plays out in our everyday, much more quotidian lives all the time.
And what struck me, because I've been there when Welcome is working with the youngsters, talking to them about their aspirations and kind of the issues that they're facing, and they're just ordinary kids. They don't look like they come from a gangland or that they have committed any serious crimes. Not all of them will have, but they just look like they could be friends of my daughter's or my daughter. And that's what actually brings it much, much closer when you confront what he's doing.
Oh, exactly that. Remember how he talks about being a bright, straight A student. And if you just transpose that boy into a more affluent or a Model C or a, you know, northern suburbs private high school, he would just be another high achiever. And I think that's what he's talking about when he mentions the word inevitability. He is trying to shift the actual train tracks, trying to rebuild that track of the train that's heading straight for prison or death. What a huge thing he's doing.
Absolutely. And I think we'll all remember that for a while. But as always, thank you for listening to This Way Up.
And especially thank you for listening to This Way Up if you found it hard going.
So true, Terry. And please, please rate and review this episode. It'll help Welcome and all the other people that we interview.